Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 65. On this episode of the podcast, we are talking about Inside Out, probably Pixar's most adult film. At the helm of Inside Out is Pete Docter, who many of you will recognize from Up, Monsters, Inc., and who had a great deal to do with Toy Story and some other Pixar films. This film runs the emotional gamut. It actually has the literal characters of joy and sadness, disgust, anger, and fear. So we get to see what it's like to be in the head of an 11-year-old girl. And amazingly, that helps us learn so much about each other and ourselves in this really, really weird, beautiful kind of way. So we talk about how much kids can get out of a film with such a high concept, how we think it worked for Pixar to use such a high concept in a film, and we ourselves talk about the gift of grief and how that kind of concept conflicts with the American narrative of how grief should typically be avoided. And we have a great discussion with Joe Darnell and first-time guest Gene from Let There Be Movies. So, here it is, episode 65, Inside Out, and A Time to Weep. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. But I'm really glad that you guys, like especially Gene. I mean, not to diminish Joe. But Gene, you know, especially your first time on the show, I'm really glad to have you here. I'm glad, you know, Joe could join us again. I always like having Joe on, and I really try to kind of throw some sports metaphors, some softballs up there for people just to hit home, especially on their first show. And, Gene, I was like, a Pixar movie. Gene's going to love this. You know, we've got all the ingredients, right? We've got Pete Docter, who, you know, directed and wrote it. And Pete Docter, for those of you who don't know, like a Pixar...
he's one of the Five Horsemen, or whatever you call them.
Yeah, of the animation apocalypse of happiness and joy or something. I don't know. But he, you know, he did Up and Monsters, Inc. He also, you know, people will usually credit him with those. But, I mean, he developed a lot of the story for Toy Story and WALL-E. Even though, you know, he didn't really have the final, I guess, say in those. And Inside Out has, like, him at the helm. So Pixar, Pete Docter, people are already on board with seeing Inside Out. It seems like it would be harder for this movie to fail than it would be succeed with some of this formula. But we've already seen this happen once this year with Tomorrowland. Very divided. As far as, like, the people who, you know, either people really liked Tomorrowland or people didn't really like it at all. Not a lot of people sitting in the middle of Tomorrowland. That, you know, that was the same formula. Disney makes a movie about imagination and Brad Bird's, you know, directing it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Why would we not go see that movie? So there was some hesitation, but you have lots of voice talent in this movie. Amy Poehler, Phyllis Smith, Bill Hader, Louis Black, Mindy Kaling.
Are you saying, Fizz, that some people didn't like this movie?
Well, I'm saying that, like, there was a lot of hesitation in wondering if this movie was going to deliver on what Pixar has historically delivered.
My theory on that is that the reason we hesitate is because the premise, it just sounds a bit...
Just too out there?
Yeah, more so toys coming to life. It's just the idea that, you know, we could buy that pretty quickly because we had been exposed to other stories that set us up for that supposed premise that toys could come to life. Mm-hmm. And there isn't really that much to buy into with several of the other Pixar stories. I think that the more charming they can make it, the bigger, the easier it is to sell it. So, you know, we all believed at one time in our lives that there were monsters under our bed. Mm-hmm. All they had to do is make them charming, and then everybody wanted to see a movie about it. In the case of this story, to say that we're going inside of an 11-year-old girl's head and it's somehow going to be interesting for 2 hours is a bigger sell. And yeah. So people who have a very limited appreciation for, I hate to bring it up, but imagination, I think are going to have a bigger problem with this movie. And I think that this is actually a huge problem with people in general today, is that because we are used to expressing our imaginations passively when we just sit down to watch the TV, play video games, or listen to some music that does all of the creative work for us so that we can just relax and casually consume something and not really use our imaginations. We're not in the habit of recalling our imaginary friends from childhood. We're not used to remembering what it was like to make believe. And that kind of flies in the face of one of my lifetime heroes. Like, I really admired the Reverend Mr. Rogers. And it was something that was ingrained in me early on. My family, my parents, they fostered creativity early on because a lot of the Darnell family tree are creative types and artists. And so they saw nothing wrong with expressing the imagination well into the adult years. But now looking at a movie like this, I can understand why some of my friends are mystified about this film, because it's like, you're asking for people to buy into something that seems like a huge whopper. You know what it reminded me of was Wreck-It Ralph. The idea that there could be like a grand central station where all these video game guys can get together and hang out and talk and like socialize, and then their lives are influencing each other in the arcade. Like, first of all, point of entry, you had to have been geeky about something at one time of your life before you'd buy into that notion.
Yeah, you'd start, yeah.
Yeah, two, you had to have some sense of imagination and the wherewithal to exercise it about your geeky lifestyle. And then you might appreciate the movie. And this film kind of falls into the same category. Like, you know, you have all these imaginative, you know, parts of the supposed brain and psyche that make complete sense if you have imagination. But if you don't have any, then you're going to feel like all of this is way too bizarre.
Well, let me say this and then pose a question. What I'm hearing you describe, Joe, is what I believe a lot of critics have pointed out in some of the earliest reviews. They say Inside Out is like Pixar's probably most daring film.
Some people said it was the most Pixar-esque Pixar film.
Yeah, and what it does is it gives us a concept that's pretty high, and so that, yes, to me kind of made me realize, especially after coming out of it, no matter whether I really enjoyed it or not, that was kind of not the point. I realized that this was probably the most adult movie I have seen Pixar make. Like, not by a little bit, you know?
But what do you mean by adult? Do you mean mature?
That's what I want you guys to answer, because, I mean, and I kind of want Gene, because I've read his review, I kind of want him to kind of take a shot at this first. And we asked, I liken this to Tomorrowland. You know, it's a movie that looks like it's being marketed to children, but some of the themes seem to be like over children's heads. And that was what we talked about when we did Tomorrowland. And I kind of want to do the same thing. So like, is Inside Out a movie for kids, or can kids or can children even enjoy this movie?
Yeah, those are all very good questions. And I raised a lot of those in my review. My issue, and this is my only issue, like Joe, you mentioned having the imagination to accept it and dive into it. I'm on board with that as far as that goes. But my only issue on this is that I feel like it misses its primary audience. Okay, so all of these animated movies, Pixar, whoever it is, they're family movies. I mean, you can take your kids to them, but everyone knows that the main target audience is children. And specifically, I would say like 5 to 10, 11, 12-year-olds. You know, teenagers are going to like it, but they're going to act like they're too cool to like it, right? But they're going to like it. Parents are going to like it because in every one of these movies, there are little doses of adult jokes that only parents are going to get. They're going to fly over the heads of kids, but the parents are going to get them, and that's kind of like a, hey, thanks for bringing your kids to see this movie. Here's a joke for you. What Inside Out does, I feel like it stays in the emotional depth and sadness that we see in the opening of Up. It stays in that realm for far too long. And like the middle third is an emotional down spiral. You know, once Riley and her family move to San Francisco and she begins experiencing all these new things, it just goes down and down and down, emotionally speaking, not the quality of the movie or anything, but emotionally speaking. Any semblance of humor is quickly jolted back down by the switch focusing on Riley and her pain and her anguish and her fear. So you get a joke or you get something funny happen, but then there's an immediate result where Riley is experiencing all these emotions, and a small child watching these is thinking, wow, that looks very sad, and it makes me feel sad. So that's where I think that Inside Out sort of fails. And I say fail in a very loose sense of the word because the movie is not a failure. I think I agree with what you said, Mikey. This may be the most adult Pixar film ever. And I think adults can get so much out of this, which I'm sure we'll touch on. Mm-hmm. But I think for the target audience, for children, I think this is either so much of this is going way over their head, and I'll get into more details, I'm sure, about specific parts. And I think it, by and large, could leave children just leaving the movie feeling sad. I can speak personally about this. I brought my 5-year-old girl and my 7-year-old boy, and I asked them both what they thought when they left, and my son said that it was sad, and that's all he said. He wouldn't really elaborate, and he looked a little bothered. Huh. He just said it was sad. Huh. So I think that it spent too long in those emotionally heavy moments, and that caused all of the other humor to not really connect as strongly as it could have.
Hmm. So, Joe, where did you land? Where do you land on this?
I didn't take my children to see it the first time around, and that was because I had a commitment to someone else to see it with them first. Nothing against taking my children to see a Pixar film. I
check it out first.
Yes. But it was because I read your review first, Gene, and then I got wary and I didn't know if I should take the kids.
Oh. Yeah. Well, now I feel bad. I scared you.
Yeah.
How does that make you feel? I felt like it was really good, and I see where you're coming from. It didn't occur to me while viewing the film, and I was viewing it with my sister, who was 19, and we're old school Pixar fans. In fact, actually, the whole family tree, there's this a perception that the Darnells are all on board with any kind of Pixar film, but we aren't on board with all of them. There was the exception of Brave. So with a film like this, I felt like I wasn't really sure what to expect after we had, what was it? We had Monsters University, Brave, and was it Cars 2 in recent years? And because this one seemed so novel, I didn't know if this would land flat because it was too adventurous or it was going to appeal too much to the little kid. I have to say, I know it's not as compelling in ways as the Toy Story films, but I feel like the Toy Story trilogy is really Pixar's best work if you look at the whole of it, like the overall exceptional quality of that overarching story. And there are people who debate whether or not WALL-E or Up is actually the best Pixar film of all time. You go there if you feel like it, but... Nope. I feel like this film is way up there. That being said, I was completely ignoring whether or not children would be on board with this film. And I wondered while I was watching the movie, is it just that this movie feels like it works for me? Is this a personal thing? Or is this working for the entire audience too? The audience was mostly full. And so there were just two jokes when the audience gave them like no response, emotional response whatsoever. And then when it came to the end of the movie, I always kind of wait to see how does everybody respond to a comedic film like this? Are they going to clap? Are they going to laugh? Are they going to give any applause? And there was. There was applause at the end of this film with a diverse group of people. So I don't want to say that I disagree with you, Gene, because I completely agree with you. And I'm actually a little bit uneasy about taking my kids to see it because I'm wondering what they're going to get from the film, because I don't think it's going to be what they expect.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Coming away from it, I'm going to be like, you know, I would have just been as happy to wait until it came out on home entertainment and show it to them together as a family when it was a little bit cheaper than buying the tickets in theater.
Yeah.
Well, I'll say this. This is how I, as a conversation moderator, agree and disagree. Let's see. So I've already admitted.
Sadness is telling you one thing and joy is telling you another.
Let's see. Anger and disgust right now are. Well, I'd say this. I mean, I've already admitted that this to me is the, like, by far the most adult Pixar film that I've watched. So I don't disagree that children will probably. I'm assuming they're going to get something out of it. I find it hard to believe that children would get nothing out of almost anything they watch because they're just. I think they're at an age where they're not just going for pure entertainment. Like it's going to spark something in them, especially a Pixar movie. I think the imagination is going to be full on. I don't think it's going to be what I got or what most adults get out of it, because children don't understand the concepts of having grown up. They don't understand the concepts of parenting. Reflecting on memories that they've really lost, things like that. So, like I said, I think it will be different. So, with that said, where I disagree is when Gene, you're using the phrase target audience, and while people, especially probably people with money, who help produce this to some degree, are assuming the target audience is kids. I would throw out this idea that I think Pixar, what sets them apart from every other animation company and has given us the quality we've had for so long, is that they're interested in telling amazing stories for all ages. Not like, I think I compared it to like Shrek at one point where it's like, oh, Shrek, they made a movie for kids and put a couple adult jokes in there so the adults wouldn't get bored. Like,
right.
Shrek is a movie for kids that hopefully the parents won't hate when they're there with them. I think Pixar makes movies that everyone is supposed to enjoy at all ages, which is like this really dramatic shift in what we think. I mean, it's fundamentally a shift away from how most or all people think about animated films, because I remember trying to explain what Inside Out was, and most people said, oh yeah, that's that new cartoon from Pixar. And I don't know why it annoyed me so much. I was like, it's not a cartoon. I was like, this is an animated film, and just because it's animated doesn't mean that it's specifically for children. And I think Pixar gets that, which is why Pixar, their films are historically more emotionally deep and thoughtful than anybody else, because they're not just, like I said, they're just not trying to throw some fart jokes in there or some subtle sex humor that only adults are going to get. They're actually like, I enjoy Toy Story without having any children around. I enjoy Incredibles without any children around. You know, like, I would watch any of those movies, not just because I have a niece or a nephew that needs to be entertained. I think they're amazing films. And I think Pixar gets that. Now, like I said, I think you could argue that there's producers and people, some making decisions money-wise, that have an idea of what the majority of the audience will be, but I would disagree that the target audience, at least of the storytellers, of Pete Doctor, is children. And so, while I think it's more adult, I don't think it misses its audience.
I could see that perhaps his intent was a target audience of anyone over the age of 11. That it would just impact, that, you know, like you were saying, Gene, that anyone who gets this movie is someone who can relate to it because they reflect on their history, their past.
Right, and they've dealt with it.
Yeah, and so anyone 12 years or older could say, wow, my childhood feels, you know, like it makes so much more sense in a way because I can relate to this movie and the story.
I think you get a lot more out of it if you're at an age, which I'm not sure exactly what, you know, scientists would say that age is, but, you know, like you're 10 or so and you have had the opportunity to be self-aware enough to be aware of disappointment in life.
Yes.
So, you know, younger kids than that, I think they'll get some general ideas that you can talk to them about, even though they're probably younger than you could have like a really long, in-depth, real-world theology conversation about it. but then again, I don't have kids that I'm having that conversation with. So, feel free to rebut if you would like.
No rebuttal. I think if their target audience is not, you know, smaller children, then I think this hits it out of the park.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's meant for everyone, then I do think it misses a large segment of that everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, thinking back on a lot of other Pixar movies, you know, WALL-E is a little bit of a high concept for younger children to grasp as well. You know, the having to leave the planet for this or that reason, and these robots gaining some level of self-awareness and, mm-hmm. and so forth. So that's a little bit of a higher level than younger children are maybe expected to be able to grasp. So you're probably onto something there that with Pixar specifically, I think they do aim for more depth. And but I do think with Inside Out that depth sort of lasted too long.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I would say.
I will say that I cried a lot more during this movie than any other Pixar film.
That's true.
And it got worse and worse.
Start to finish.
I will never cry, I don't think, is at any movie as much as I did at Toy Story 3.
But that was the thing. Toy Story 3 had two parts. And even going back and watching Toy Story 3 again, I can limit like my emotional meltdown to one part. So I went and saw Inside Out twice. And mm-hmm. the first time I saw it, probably from about 3 minutes into the film, I started at least being teary-eyed because some parts were so beautiful and some things were displayed or some depicted so beautifully. And then it just every 15 minutes or so, there's something that really hit me. And so I was like, okay, that was the first time. Didn't know what I was getting into. The second time, I was like, I know what I'm getting into. It's totally not going to hit me. And while I didn't start weepy-eyed like 3 minutes in, there were probably four parts where I have at least one tear running down my, you know, my man cheek. So, the crying of the grown men crying angle has been so, noted that, I mean, we even got a tweet today from someone asking if we were going to, have a podcast called Inside Out and Grown Men Weeping Openly in Theaters, you know? And I was like, well, we will be talking about grown men weeping openly in theaters. It's just, I would say that, you know, that punch from Toy Story 3 was good. Heck, the punch from Finding Nemo always got me.
Like, yeah, me
there
too.
At the end. But, I mean, consistently having depth that I can't, like, that doesn't surprise me. Usually, you know, you're surprised, you didn't see it coming, you have the emotional reaction, but in the future, you know it's coming, you can, you know, stone yourself kind of against it. Couldn't do it again. I saw it, you know, second time Inside Out, basically the same as the first. Just these beautifully orchestrated moments.
Yeah. Yeah, I had two moments from Inside Out where I was like that. Even on the second watch, I was welling up a little bit. Now, Joe, I have a question. So have you not taken your kids yet?
I have not. Going to see it with them this coming weekend.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would still, even my comments aside, I would still say bring your kids. Because, as we learned from the movie, being sad is not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
And even if it makes them sad, that's not a terrible thing. That's something we can talk about more.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's starting the conversation. I mean, and, you know, it's... Again, I don't have children, but I would hope that I am... I can't remember what the podcast we talked about it on, but it was another one that was kind of aimed at children. It might have been the Cinderella one, but, you know, like, when we talk about entertainment not being mindless, like, we don't mean just for, like, adults. Like, if you're taking your kid to see a movie, I would even more highly encourage you to engage, like, what they get out of it, because they're going to see it from a different perspective, you know?
Yeah.
And so Gene, you mentioned sadness. As I transition, and I feel like we've already probably kind of spoiled a piece or two, but we are spoiler full, so we're going to talk about everything. And there is a lot of talk about sadness and sadness being okay. And the thing that strikes me a lot watching this movie, and one of the first things I thought about coming out of it, is that, like, especially in America, or just the Western world, we are told to avoid pain at all costs. We flee from things that make us sad. If we do, if sadness creeps in, like you said, we mask it. You know, we hide it. Grown men don't cry. You know, especially like the masculine doesn't show that emotion. And we're told to seek happiness above everything. Like, it's the goal. Like, you know, the pursuit of happiness. It's in the Constitution. You know, that's what America is about, you know, especially America, Western world in general. So how does this film, to you guys, present a view of grief or sadness that is more in line with a Christian understanding of grief and sadness?
Wow. I'll let you tackle that one first, Dean.
Oh, wow.
So, well, I've read some good reviews that brought this up a couple of times.
So, all of our emotions are a part of our human nature. So, sadness is one of those. We shouldn't try to avoid it. You know, you mentioned that always trying to pursue our happiness is kind of the status quo today.
Mm-hmm.
The movie does such a great job of, you know, finally, when it comes to its climax, it does such a great job of pointing out how some of your greatest moments of happiness, some of your greatest memories, can come from some of your lowest moments. And in the movie, and like you said, we're doing spoilers now.
Yeah.
So in the movie, Riley is, she's 7 or 8 or whatever she is in this memory, and she just lost the game for her team. And she is so depressed and down, and she's sitting in a tree all by herself, and she is so sad. And when Joy is talking to Sadness about that day, Joy mentions how all of her team came and lifted her up, and it's such a great day. And Sadness says, "Yeah, I remember that. That's when we lost the game." Well, how can those happen on the same day within the same moment? You know, how can that be? Well, it's because her parents came alongside her and encouraged her and talked to her. And then her teammates came alongside her and encouraged her and lifted her up. And that reminded me so much of in Galatians 6, where Paul talks about bearing one another's burdens and fulfilling the law of Christ. Now, back when Paul wrote that, he's talking about not just emotional burdens, but physical burdens too, physical trials that they were going through. So today, we may not have the physical trials that Paul was writing about, but boy, do we have some emotional ones. Family breakdown is an enormous trial, not just for the church, but for all Americans and everybody in the world. That's something that we can come alongside one another and find each other in those moments of sadness and just be there, just talk to them. You don't have to solve it for them right there, and that's something that I really struggle with. You know, I feel like this may be a guy thing. We try to find the solutions to problems. You know, you're feeling bad. Okay, well, tell me why and I'll fix it.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't have to be the case. We can bear those burdens with one another, with our fellow Christians, and just be there. There's another moment in the movie where, and it's really kind of a turning point moment for Joy, because Bing Bong, the imaginary friend, just has his spaceship or whatever, you know, taken away and let down into whatever that's called, the sea of forgetfulness or something.
Yeah, the abyss of the bottomless subconscious.
That sounds way better than what I said.
And better than what they even called it in the movie.
Oh, well, there you go. So, but Bing Bong is so sad about this. He's crying, you know, Candy, and Joy is just annoyed by this. She doesn't want this to take up any time. She needs to move on and get back to Riley. But Sadness comes alongside him and just sits there and listens to him. She doesn't try to solve it. In fact, she relates to him. She has some sympathy for him. She tells him about times when she was sad and, you know, saying she knows how that feels. And you see it in Joy's expression, which is such a beautiful moment. She kind of has that, you know, like you see when a dog kind of tilts their head to the side, they're kind of trying to figure something out. That's kind of how Joy was. She's like, oh,
what just happened? Look at
that. It just worked. How'd you do that? And I think she even asks Sadness, you know, how'd you do that? But it's such a great message that sad moments don't have to be sad moments forever. We can come alongside and bear one another's burdens and turn those into moments of great joy, moments of, you know, turning the corner, turning it around and coming out of that sadness and moving on. So that was a great moment in that movie.
I think when we're growing up, we have experiences with people we determine are our best friends. And it's usually because they met that kind of need, that kind of emotional need, like Joy could or Sadness could. You know, everybody's got a best friend story, I hope anyway, where someone came alongside of them and was really there for them emotionally. And it's that kind of connection when you realize, okay, this person was there for me. And not only were they there for me, but they truly understood me. And to be truly understood is something that is explored close to the end of the film. And that was really cool when that kind of fulfillment came about. And so that was something that Joy was discovering.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so this is... One of the
going back to what you were saying, Fizz, I wanted to make a few more comments about the emotions brought forth in the Bible.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you know, I think that there are some books that really bring up emotions like over and over again in a really good way, profound way even, like the Book of Psalms. You know, I was just thinking about Psalms 100, which was one of the first chapters that, you know, I ever memorized. Got it here. Make a joyful noise to the Lord, all the earth. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come into his presence with singing. Know that the Lord, he is God. He made us, and we are his. We are his people, and the sheep of his pasture. Enter the gates with thanksgiving, and into his courts with praise. Give thanks to him. Bless his name, for the Lord is good. His steadfast love endures forever, and his faithfulness to all generations. That is just a small sampling of what you get from emotions in the Book of Psalms. And you don't just get joy. You get a wide array of sadness and even disgust and anger through that enormous book. And it seems, you know, very poetical. Yes, it seems like you're learning a lot about not an 11-year-old girl or a shepherd boy, but you're actually learning about, like, the deep-rooted emotions of King David, a grown man who was a mighty warrior, who killed a lot of people, who saw a lot of blood, and he still wrestled with a lot of things. And as he described them, he brought them into faith, and he talked about his relationship with God. But oftentimes, his fears and his anger issues were brought about from the world, no different from how we all experience anger and fear issues today. And I certainly think that there are ways in which if I were trying to counsel, you know, one of my children through some emotional problems, difficulties like I faced as a child, I'll be like, you know, it's time that we need to read some of the Psalms again. I think that, you know, this could provide a pretty powerful, you know, help to you. And we can go through this together a little bit easier, knowing that not just, you know, everyday people like us experience these tumultuous emotional problems, but we even have someone as incredible as King David to the end of his life who wrestled with these issues with fear and everything else.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I am I'm a big fan of especially the Psalms. It gives you the entire emotional spectrum. Because, you know, you're reading there from Psalm 100, and it's praise and singing, and, you know, and people are like,
it's,
oh,
it's joy concentrated.
Yeah, it's this, okay, well, of course, I want to feel joy, I want to be singing, I want to praise, but you have Psalms like Psalm 88, which, like, you know, lots of times you'll see a Psalm kind of take a dip and say, oh, you know, these terrible things are happening, but... you know, you're still this, and we can still be encouraged. But Psalm 88 ends. Like, the last line, you know, you have taken from me friend and neighbor. Darkness is my only friend. And it ends. It completely allows itself to be in this, what J.R. Forresteros in his review calls the gift of grief. Just, I mean, we have an entire book in the Bible called Lamentations, you know, like it's something, sadness is necessary. And as James 1 tells us, is inevitable. Like, this isn't something that we can run from. This isn't something that we can put a mask on or completely avoid. And this is like another, like why Christian cinema usually is one of my biggest pet peeve of it, is because I feel like it's one of the biggest transgressors. I'm like, read your own source material. Almost every Christian, you know, I do the quote marks, bunny ears, every Christian film typically resolves every one of their stories with a super, not just a happy ending, but like a super happy and ending that is so contrary to real life that it actually makes me question if they understand what, like, some of the goals of the actual Christian life are. You know, they put this picture out there that says, you know, person's life was sad, or they were grieving. And then they found God, and then everything came together and was joyful and happy, and they were happy. And so they were not happy, and then they found, like, God, or God found them, or however the particular movie puts it, and then they were happy. And it just, it ignores pain. And I think something revelatory that was so timely is I just got to be a part of a seminar this past weekend on... about pastoral counseling, and the gentleman who was kind of teaching us, Dr. Steve Shores, he said that pain reminds us that we are homesick, that we're created for a world that is not this one. And as long as we're not in the world that we were created for, there's always going to be pain. And the big question is kind of, what do we do with that pain? Do we let that pain push us to seek safety and control? You know, do we try to control our emotions? Do we always try to find the safety of just what makes us happy? Or do we let that pain remind us that we need something otherworldly to comfort us? And I just... like I said, it just felt so timely because, like, he had actually just seen Inside Out too, so we kept talking about, like, core memories and our islands and like I said, the gift of grief. We didn't call it the gift of the grief at the time, but we were both talking about, like, how joy and sadness kind of go hand in hand. And, you know, Gene, I know you already talked about that, just how out of sadness comes joy, lots of times, and how they're not opposed.
No, they're not at all. They, they can act isolated, you know, they can feel isolated when you're in the moment, but I think that's part of the comfort in knowing that we have a Savior in Jesus that we can turn to, that we can lie all of our fears and all of our anxieties on, and we don't have to dwell in them. You know, we don't have to live in them forever. We can turn that sadness, that weakness that we might feel, we have a weakness about ourselves, we can turn that over to Christ, and we can say, that's not mine to carry, that's not my load to carry. And like you said, I think it can point us back to the fact that that's not how we're supposed to be. We have another place that we need to be going, and we need to be lying all those emotions on the Father in order to get there.
Yeah. And when you bring in Christ as like the mediator in that particular case, I go back to what you said before. And I think the film explicitly is trying to point out, which is why I don't think any of us missed it. And that's that sadness allows us to like empathize and connect. And, like joy can allow us to connect. We can all celebrate together. I mean, you know, Ecclesiastes tells us there's a time to weep and a time to laugh. So all these things can allow us to connect. But
right, because we can't be joyful about everything that happens. Some things are going to happen that are innately sad. And if you try to put on a fake smile and just push through it and say, I can be happy no matter what my circumstance, you're really being like, what, a robot? Or not even a robot. You're being like the freaking Scarecrow from The Wizard of Oz. You have no brain.
Yeah,
and if you think that looks like heart and soul, and if you think that that's spiritual and that makes you filled with the Holy Spirit, then you're really missing out on, like what the Bible illustrated that Jesus went through. There were times that he experienced full on awesome joy, sadness, disgust, anger. It's pretty righteous. I mean, it's pretty awesome to see that that kind of thing came through. Even God, throughout his life. And not just these emotions, but other emotions that weren't even explored in this film.
Well, and that's part of the thing. So when we, especially as Christians, and I think this is something that non-Christians definitely have a hard time, because Christians have an incredibly hard time understanding it, is...
why do bad things happen and make us sad?
Yeah, well, like we are Bing Bong, okay? Like we just had our rocket pushed in, our metaphorical rocket pushed into the chasm of forgetfulness, all right? And we're like, God can't understand, because he's God, so he can't understand sadness. And that's where Christ comes in as like the mediator. He's like, I understand. Like I completely understand what it is to feel pain, and he can totally relate, having not just sat up on a cloud, a wispy cloud with sunshine and rainbows. Like he came to Earth and experienced the pain of a fallen world, and says like, I get it, but. And you know, like I said, sits in that sadness, but points us towards joy, because, like I said, they're hand in hand.
Right. I've experienced this too, and I've conquered it.
Yeah.
And so we don't need to have fear in being lost and all that. We can lay it on Jesus, and he'll conquer it for us.
So, maybe to try to lighten things up just a little bit, because I mean, all that was great. I want to not jump back to complete silliness, but jump back maybe one level and ask you guys, like, we can see how this movie parallels how the Christian life views the purpose and the usefulness of grief and sadness. But is there a way that this movie can help not just parents understand their children's emotions, but maybe the emotions of other adults and like possible.
I think it does that subconsciously. Like when you're done watching this movie, you're nodding your head, you're wiping away a few tears, and you can't help yourself but say, like in your head and your heart, man, that makes so much sense. And before you realize it, you're like, I don't mean to sound like a sissy or a wuss that just thinks about feelings and stuff, but no matter how hard you are, no matter what guy you are that just enjoys sports ball and beer and, you know, turns out your children and tells them to leave because, you know, so the guys can do guy things.
Put the foot
I think
down.
That you're I mean, like, you're going to be totally engrossed in this a wider range of how they express personality, like the sacrifices that are made when, you know, the islands of personality are disconnected and destroyed. Mm-hmm. For a while there, it seems like you're suckered into why this seems like such a big deal, because you're thinking, like, unconsciously you're aware of, like, well, if, you know, I am this this chess player hobbyist, you know, like, I'm really engrossed in chess, and I can't imagine who I would be if I lost chess in my life. So you're really rooting that, you know, Riley will be able to recover or keep her island of hockey, you know. Yeah. Because that's something you can relate to no matter what your interest is.
No, I agree. Like, so Gene, you talked about, you know, like, taking your kids to see it and they left sad. Like, did that, like, give you a springboard to have conversations, or did they see anything like, oh, this is when I was sad? Are they just too young, or?
Well, I think they were too young.
Does it change how you see, or you as a parent kind of, like, look at how you're going to interact with them in the future?
Yeah, it does. And one moment specifically, and, you know, right now, that maybe the only practical thing, like, thing I would going to make sure that I change. So when they had just moved into the apartment and Riley is going to bed for the first time, and you've got this interplay in with the emotions, and they're all kind of panicking a little bit, trying to figure out, like, why is nothing going right? Why isn't this like it used to be? All these things have changed. And Joy starts to kind of step away from the console a little bit, and she's sort of panicking a little bit too. You can see mm-hmm. it on her face. And the mother comes in, you know, switching back out to Riley now, which, by the way, the switches between seeing what was going on with Riley and then seeing the emotions, whether the emotions reactions are leading to those or as a result of those, that was terrific. Mm-hmm. Going between those was awesome. But the mother comes in, and the mother starts praising her, Riley, for being on such good behavior and being so happy. She says, "You're our happy little girl. Your dad really needs us right now. This job is a struggle for him. We can be happy for him, can't we?" And that's not an exact quote, but she says something yeah. to that effect. Like, she's praising Riley for her happiness. And Riley's a happy girl. She's had a good upbringing to this point, good experiences. So she's a happy girl. And her mom is trying to encourage that feeling. And it's totally from a good place. You know, her mom wants her to be happy, and she's trying to encourage her to be happy and trying to bring her along with her to help her dad in this new job. But Riley wasn't happy. She wasn't sure about a lot of things going on with all these changes. And it really hits home at the end when Riley has returned back to her parents and she's just kind of laying it all out there. She just says, "I'm not happy. I know you want me to be happy, but I'm not." So they got me thinking, you know, when are the times where, and this is nowhere an apples to apples comparison, but when are the times where, like, we're shopping at the grocery store and I just need my kid to behave for 20 minutes. And I say, "Listen, just put a smile on your face for 20 minutes. I'll get you some M&Ms when we get to the register." And I'm forcing them to adopt this emotion that they are not feeling at the moment for whatever reason it might be. So it's really helped me to try to think sort of third personally on my engagement with my kids and say, okay, I'm wanting them to feel this way, but what are they probably really feeling right now? And how can I either relate to that or be in that with them? You know, the mom is going through all this stuff too. You know, the yeah. moving van wasn't there. None of their stuff is there. They tried to figure out earlier where to go to eat. It's all hectic right now. The mother's feeling this as well, but the mother's trying to be strong for the daughter, to encouraging her to be happy. So she's going through this as well. And as a parent, I think that can be a good lesson to try not so much to force an emotion onto your children, but try to do more of figuring out what they're feeling, because you can avoid them running away from home later on.
We hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
I was going to say, bringing up the running away part of the story, that was when I think it was getting harder and harder for the younger children to relate to. Would you say, Gene? Yeah.
Big time, dude. When that control council just starts turn the black. Control center just starts turning black, that is like scary, man. I mean, and you can see Riley, she's going dead in her eyes. There's mm-hmm. nothing there. And I think, I don't know which emotion it was, maybe fear, just says, we can't make her feel anything anymore. She's not feeling anything. She's closing off completely because she's been driven to this point. So that, man, that is such a powerful moment.
Well, and that's why I feel like a number of reviews that I read before I even went to see the film is kind of mentioned or said some form of, this film may change how we understand like mental illness or depression or false assumptions of happiness or appearances of happiness, and like it'll forever change how we look and interact when we have those people in our lives, or if it's us, like understanding, having people understand us better when those things are happening, not just be like, why can't you just be happy? Why can't you just,
right.
you know, make a switch? Like it's there's more to it than just smiling.
Yeah.
Which leads me to wonder, like Joe, did you feel like this film gave you any like personal epiphanies about like how your own mind might work?
Yeah, but at the same time, it felt like it shouldn't have, because did either of you get at times that this movie reminded you of Winnie the Pooh cartoons from Disney in the 90s? And it was like, you know, there'd be some kind of like rabbit trail, no pun intended, through the 100-acre woods, and they wind up looking for heffalumps and woozles. And it's like, why on earth are they passing this off to kids that, you know, some of this stuff is just scary, but most of it is nonsense and silly. And I don't understand what Disney's trying to teach our kids, if they're trying to teach us anything. Is this just purely for entertainment value or what? I don't understand what they're doing in the 100-acre wood. And I had that experience, like in the that little tickle of an idea in the back of my head when watching this film, because I was like, you know, this feels like Heffalumps and Woozles again, but actually this time it makes sense. Like Pixar said, Disney, here, let us show you how to make sense of Heffalumps and Woozles, and they pulled it off. I was like, I don't know that many people could have done that, and they articulated things I think that would take most storytellers, writers, if you were to try and make up this movie outside of Pixar, it would have taken you much longer to arrive at this quality of story, because I think that Pixar lended themselves to the story. Like one of the reviews, I forget which one it was, I was reading, You Passed On, Fizz, was really great. Pointed out that a lot of the Pixar, and I guess the reason I was thinking of Apple was because Pixar and Apple were owned by Steve. Anyway, that's another
Rabbit
podcast.
Trail.
That's another part of the Acrewood. One of the things about Pixar is that their creative talent is often led by a director who has surrounded himself with his peers who are other Pixar directors, and they all heavily influence by sharing ideas when they're storyboarding a new movie. So like one of the guys comes in and he's like Pete Docter and says, hey, I have an idea for a movie. It's, you know, inspired by my own experience with my own very young daughter. And I thought, why can't we tell a story about getting inside of the head of a little girl? And they decide, hey, let's make this into a movie. So they fictionalize the idea based on some of Pete Docter's own experience. And then from there, you have all of these brilliant minds acting like the personality archetypes at Control Center, all vying for the control or for every little beat of the movie while they're coming up with the idea for the script. And they're carefully caring for the story like it were its own thing, its own living entity. And they really want to see it survive and to do well. And it's just a mirror of what they do in this movie. Like, I think that some of the way in which they depicted the realm of the emotions, the memories, and how all of this works inside of a little girl's head was like a metaphor for Pixar's own creative talent and work and how they do it on the inside. So they feel like they are all operating for the well-being of this little girl called Pixar. And they pull it off brilliantly. I think that's sort of a metaphor that they couldn't help themselves with when they were making this film.
So it reminds me of another scene, that almost meta example, reminds me of a scene in the film that I assumed it could have been cut. Like, I don't think the film would have changed really at all if it wasn't there, and that's when they go into abstract thought.
Yes.
But I think the whole reason it's in there is because they acknowledge, like, it's a metaphor for what the film is. Because as soon as they go in there, the two little mind bean things, they say, oh, what are we trying to understand today? Loneliness.
Yeah.
And you realize that Inside Out is just like an abstract thought on trying to understand what an emotion is. And if it wasn't for that metaphor, like, and the fact that I think they just indulged themselves a little bit just to have like animation jokes. I there was no reason for that to be in there except for they're pointing out how hard it is to tell a story about a concept instead of just a, you know, a person does X, Y, and Z and then they win. But yeah, it's that whole metaphor for, Inside Out being a metaphor for how Pixar works. Like, you know, I see them even putting that inside their own films. Gene, was there anything that you felt like was an epiphany for you about how you work, how your brain works?
Not so much, I guess. I being there with my kids really kind of put me in sort of their mindset and trying to see what they would think about all this. So,
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say it completely. This gets in a little bit into my come on moment. But like you mentioned with abstract thought, there's a lot to like about that, but what does a 7-year-old understand about that at all?
So actually it's about that time to shift into it anyway, but I want to say this right before I do. I think something that I knew but I couldn't put my finger on, and I think that, you know, one of the things to praise this film for is taking concepts that are very hard to like visualize and kind of giving it a name. And that was like the whole concept of core memories to me. Thinking like, because I realize there are things in my past. You know, it's like when you go to counseling, they're like, "Oh, I'm assuming, because I'm too awesome for counseling." But just, you know, like talking to counselors and stuff, they're like, "You know, we're trying to get at the thing that has shaped you."
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
And so it makes me think back and go, you know, what made me like, entertainment so much. Like, what was that thing that happened to me that said movies are amazing? Or what happened to me when I was like, what memory would be sitting there in my core memory thing that said I really, really enjoy watching football? Or what was it that happened when I was not married to my wife that eventually said, like, I'm gonna have like Wife Island, you know, and I'm going to like, that's going to be a big thing for me. Like, you know, and you know, you can apply that to anybody. And so it was really cool. It gave me a lot to reflect about, like, what were pinnacle moments, you know?
Yeah.
So,
well, and another, along that line, I think that there's a lot of people who can't appreciate the islands of personality in other people, especially if your personality is very different from theirs. And this is one of the clashes of, you know, married couples themselves. I mean, like that was comically addressed in the movie. They didn't actually show mom and dad's own personality islands, but they depicted how their emotions were set in stone after decades of practicing the same emotions and tastes and interests over and over and over again. And so just that alone, sort of like it was not exactly eye-opening to realize, oh, it's okay for other people to be different from me. It wasn't quite to that extent, but it was certainly something that helped me appreciate, like, and also even hope that other people who have a difficulty understanding other people's personalities, which is a big problem in this world, a huge need, that something like this movie can actually influence how people understand and appreciate the other people around them.
Yeah.
That could happen with a movie like this.
Those core thoughts and the islands that they produced were such great items to have in there. You think of some of the saddest moments in films you watch, and a lot of times it's when a character dies, right? Or a character sacrifices themselves or whatever. In this movie, when the first island goes down, the island of goofiness, and it, as that island is crashing down, breaking into pieces, it's showing flashes of memories that are associated with that island. When Riley's jumping on her bed with her parents, when they first started doing the monkey face thing that they do together, and now all that's crashing down and those things are gone, and that part of her as Riley, that part's gone. That's never going to be the same again. That was so, like, that my heart just sank just thinking about all these moments that I've had with my kids and thinking, boy, those are going to disappear one day. Right now it's really cute for me to let my son run in from two rooms away and just tackle me full bore and act like I'm dead. But when he's 17, that's not, number one, it's not going to be very fun for me. And number two, he's going to be way too cool for that to be a thing anymore. Yeah. That's going to come crashing down one day. And that was so strong. And I think that is so strong because it is something that Pete Docter saw happening in his own daughter. So much of this story is the story of Pete's daughter and the changes that she had gone through as well, and him making those come alive in this film. And man, those I'm glad you brought those up, Mikey, because those core moments and those islands, and even at the end when you see all the islands are now just an amalgamation of all these emotions together, those are so great. And like you said, it really helps to put a pinpoint on something that could be very influential, very important to someone, and understand how that could just disappear and just crash away in an instant.
Yeah. Oh, like that's what that concept of the islands, it was one thing to have it, to me personally, to have those islands be depicted like they were at first, because when we come back, we only get a glimpse of it and they don't even talk about it really. But I noticed that once the core memories had like emotional depth and what I would consider like emotional complexity and maturity.
Yes, complexity.
Those islands weren't just like a fun island.
Yeah.
Like the islands were bigger and they were like a mix of things. And it wasn't just it was almost like, you know, when you're a child, you're going to have very childlike understanding of things, but then you get older and not always in a good way, but I think there's a lot of benefit to, you know, being able to see things more complex and building a more complex understanding of that, and that giving your personality more depth, how you interact with other people more depth. Unfortunately, things like Vampire Thing Island, you know, things like that, but like there your personality just grows and it becomes, I don't know, more interesting, you know?
Yeah.
Like, It was just really cool to see the diversity once the emotions became complex. But like I said, we're kind of about at that time, especially as long as it's going to take us to get through favorite moments. So we'll quickly hit come on moments. So Gene, what was it about this that that didn't work?
All right. So my come on moment, and it's an extension of the fault I found in the film not hitting certain segment of it, of its audience. My come on moment is when they went to the prison of the subconscious where they found all these scary things and the clown and stuff. By this point in the film, it felt like to me that they just had a list of areas of the mind that they wanted to get to. Okay, they've hit imagination land, you've hit abstract thought, you've gone to dreamland. Okay, what's next? Okay, we're going to go to subconscious thought now, as if we've not already made this way over the head for all 8-year-olds. Let's go to subconscious thought. They'll understand that, right? And even on the train, they're listing off all these other compartments of the mind that they didn't go to. It's like, oh, hey, look over there. That's this or that's that. And I'm just thinking, all right, I get it. The mind is super complex and deep, but go ahead and keep covering that stuff because you haven't confused every kid in the audience yet. Come on.
I think that's fair. I mean, like, you know, I would say that I hope that a kid would think that a mind is incredibly complex when they come away from this film, but I think you've made a really good case for it being maybe a little too much, and I think that's completely fair.
And along that line, it's actually difficult to understand why a clown has to be creepy, I think, in the subconscious jail.
Because they always are.
Yeah, but see, that's the thing, is like, you know that when you're older, but do you know that when you're a child? Because they do show up at birthday parties, so why on earth would everybody have this universal understanding that clowns are creepy? I think a lot of kids would actually be introduced to the idea in this movie that clowns are supposed to be creepy because everybody just knows that. That would be something that not everybody would know when they're 7 or 8 years old. And it may be enough to disturb them.
Well, then what was your come on moment?
I didn't really have a distinct come on moment, but I guess the closest thing to it was that they have the, what did they call it? DreamWorks, studio sequences.
Yeah. Dream Studios.
And it was the moment when, Fear was criticizing the beats of the story of the dreams, and he's like, what, now you're gonna not have any pants? And you know, she looks down and suddenly she doesn't have any pants, and there was a part of me that thought that is so supposed to be funny, but it just didn't work. It didn't work. And that was one of the other moments I stopped to think, like, is anyone else laughing at this? And nobody, I kid you not, nobody was laughing at that gag. So it was kind of wasted, considering that it consumed about 2 or 3 seconds of the film. And that's the closest thing to a come on moment.
Yeah.
So I would say that for me, and I've already talked about this, because I love this film so much, even the parts that I have a problem with, I completely see, because immediately, both times I watched it, them walking through abstract thought bored me a little bit. I mean, but when you consider it's like 3 minutes of a 94-minute film, it's not that big of a deal. Because I think you could have completely taken it out and we still would have gotten that, you know, Bing Bong can't read and Sadness may have known the better way to go, because we see other instances of that. So I was like, at first I didn't think it added anything to the film. And I still think it could be cut. But I also appreciate, like I said, I think them basically having a, doing two things. One is the metaphor for what the film is, or basically having a character come on the screen and actually saying what the film is doing, which I think is pretty ingenious.
Yeah.
And two, I, you know, if you're an animator, like, you have to find a way to really enjoy your craft or kind of like laugh at your own thing. You know, directors get to make certain kind of shots that are ridiculous or have certain kind of jokes. So screenwriters get to put certain things in. I feel like the abstract thought was basically animators, basically having like an inside joke, like,
yes,
animation is so funny. Look at these things that we had to overcome. So like I said, I appreciated that. Could have been cut from the film. So it's the closest thing that I could think of to something that really kind of
I can see that. But yeah, kind of indulgent of them there. I agree.
Mm-hmm. But you know what? You make a film this good, I'm fine if you take 3 minutes to indulge in something that amuses you. All right. So we're ending big. Favorite moments. Gene, go.
You know, for as emotionally rich as this movie was, and as much as we can keep going on and on and on about the emotional interactions, interchanges between the parents, the daughter, all the emotions in her head, my favorite moment is kind of a silly one. It's the first trip into the parents' heads at the dinner table. you don't go into, and you're not in this movie up to that point, just assuming that Riley is the only one that has these self-aware emotions. That's just kind of the world we have, so that's what we're going with. But it's a nice surprise, I think, to quickly zoom into the parents' head and watch this second layer interaction between the emotions of the mom and dad and then the emotions of the daughter corresponding to all of those emotions. You have the cliche detached dad, and he's just daydreaming about, some sport or something. You have, the emotions in the mom at that moment, daydreaming about the Brazilian helicopter that they just let that one get away. And then the dad's emotions going through the process of deciding to put the foot down. That was hilarious to me. I love that because that's like what I do. I mean, when my kids are acting up, I have a stern daddy voice of discipline that I go into, and I just start counting, right? You count to three, and then I don't know what you do after that.
Then the foot is down.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I'll just start counting, and I'll say one, and my kids know that's my voice, and they're to do what they're to do now. But for Riley's emotion of anger, just giving it right back to the dad's emotions, which all strangely enough look like anger, was so funny to me. You know, he's pounding on the control console and he's just, you know, you want some more? Here you go. It was just so funny. And so diving into the other brains, other emotions was hilarious to me. And then just the kicker at the end, diving into the mind of that 12 or 13 year old boy when she comes up to him, Bunsen, and they're all just panicking. It's a girl. What do we do? Oh, that's hilarious.
That was great.
Yes. Quite. And for me, I think it would have to be along those lines, Gene. There were several little bits like that were on equal footing, that were just so on the nose, good humor, great examples of their characters at work. And that's one of those moments where you're applauding, you know, this cartoon film. And both of those times. Another one was when, and this was the one that was the kicker for me, even though the film didn't give it as much attention as some of the others, it was the moment when, going through Imagination Land, suddenly they happen upon like all these trophies. And they, so Joy gets a first place prize trophy. It's this enormous thing, and she's so happy about it. And then they pin a little prize that's green. It just has a capital P on it, onto Sadness. And so Joy's like, yes, I got first place. And Sadness is like, oh, participation award. Great.
Yeah, that's
great. That was my special moment.
Let's see. So here's my bullet list. And I think this is, like I said, this is why I knew I liked this so much, because I couldn't pick. I kicked myself for not getting this until about the end of the second time watching it, but I completely missed that it was called The Train of Thought.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, Train of Thought. Yep, I'm an idiot. but then I loved it because I was like, that's such a great, picture.
Go on. I got to add to the pile, but go ahead.
Okay. Cause it might be what it made you think about, which was the fact that they knock over the facts and opinions.
Yes.
and you know, they're like, whatever.
Yeah. They all look the same.
Yeah. Let's see. My next piece was, I feel like I have to mention this because I harp on it in so many other reviews, is at the beginning of this film, there is a huge exposition dump, and I almost always hate exposition dumps because I find it to be pretty lazy. I think it's pretty, in general, you know, 9 out of 10 times, it's usually lazy writing. And towards the end of the exposition dump at the beginning of this film, I go, oh my God, that was an exposition dump. Yeah. And I realized that I didn't care because it was so well done.
Yeah, when those work, they really work. But when they don't, man, it really drags it down.
It just sticks out, yeah. So there's lots of obvious things that are, like, more conceptual, and we've kind of hit on lots of these. Like, I mean, I thought the animation was really great.
Yes.
You know, like, every time, like, Joy was on the screen, I thought about how easy it could have been to make her, like, a cutout character. And instead, like, almost every piece of her skin was, like these little... They had this movement to it.
Yeah, every
shot.
Yeah, that was true about all of the emotions. That if the closer you got to them, you realized that like their entire form was like bubbly little particles that were
mm-hmm.
all super close together, but also
always moving
yeah. around each other, and no definitive lines. Yeah, it was really interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I really like the fact that, and you know, what we talked about right there at the end before we got to the wrap up part, the creativity of this movie and showing us in not a cliche way what it looks like to be in someone's head. You know, like the depictions of memory, how we forget things, how the gum commercial keeps coming back up all the time.
That's great.
You know, that stuff, just that was so imaginative. let's see, we talked about the islands, you know, once the memories were multicolored, how that gave depth to so much more. That goes into that creativity thing. And I would say I wrap it up with two things, now that I've given you already like 50 things. and they're the two parts that hit me harder than anything. And that I think, I actually, when I was making my notes earlier today about this, I even started tearing up. And that's when Bing Bong jumps out of the rocket.
Oh my gosh, don't talk about it.
And he jumps out of the rocket, Gene.
He disappears.
And he says, take her to the moon for me, Joy.
All right, hold on, guys. I gotta go.
you know, and it makes Bing Bong, who could have been a completely throwaway character, like, he's going to be the character that you probably remember about this movie.
Oh, man. Yeah. Actually, Doctor said that Richard Kind, who voiced him, was actually crying when he said that line, take her to the moon for me, Joy. That just makes it sink in even more, man. That was, for a character who's so silly, you don't expect that.
No.
Nope, not at all. I mean, how many movies out there would love to be able to give you a character who's only on screen for so much and completely wrecks you like that?
Yeah.
Okay, since you brought it up, Mike, can I just point out that was something that really struck me while going through the story, that every one of the emotions and other beings in the imaginary world, not just imagination land, but like everything in her head, that had the occasion to express their interest and their concern for Riley, it demonstrated that no matter what their position, no matter what they were meant to do, whatever they were there for, they all intimately and completely 100% loved Riley. And that was something Sadness expressed, that Joy expressed many times over. And you got that notion from all of them, even anger. Like, it wasn't that disgust was disgusted by anything and everything that was happening. It was that disgust was disgusted by things that were happening, but always in Riley's interest. And that was really cool. That would be really hard to pull off.
Mm-hmm.
And to do it as sickeningly sweet as they did it in this movie, and to do it and not be sickening. Like, even when Anger comes up with his brilliant idea, when he does it because he cares about Riley.
Right.
And he's only doing something brash with anger, impulsiveness, because he's trying to help people. He's trying to help everyone. And that was so cool. And they did that with Bing Bong as well. So like when they're just walking through the aisles of the long-term memory, they can't help themselves but look at all of the little memories, like they're a part of a great collection that they all revel in. They all just love that they can behold these. It's sort of like the collector coming into this movie. Like, you know, they're all collectors of all these things. So every time one of those special orbs is created, they love that they were a part of that. And that is why it's special to them. They even love those little orbs.
Yeah, you have a bunch of little mini arcs too. You have the big arc with Joy learning about the value of sadness, but you have a lot of mini arcs because sadness and fear and disgust and anger all defer to Joy, assuming that happiness is the best and only thing that Riley should be experiencing. They all want her to take control over the console, right? So when they see sadness at the end, go up there and take control herself and run the show for a little while, they all kind of learn, you know, hey, look, this sadness made this happen. She brought the console back to life. So that they all were deferring to happy or to Joy because they thought it was in Riley's best interest, like you were saying, Joe. But then they all come to their own sort of recognition that, hey, we're all in her best interest. So yeah, that was a great point.
And then they get the upgraded console with all the swear words.
Guess she really needed that.
Yeah. All right. So I end with this, and this is like the part where I don't think I'll ever be able to watch this without it hitting hard. And I feel like it should have been so cheesy, because there was no way to not see it coming. But when Joy and Sadness push the button at the same time and it cut to Riley in just the smallest way, like going from like this crying face to this comforted face.
Yeah, she lets out a heavy sigh.
Yeah, just being embraced by her parents who just basically admitted to her that they're sad too.
Yeah.
And there's that connection moment. I did the same thing. I was like, how many movies would kill to have a connection moment like this?
Yeah.
And they just did it effortlessly. like I said, that gets me every time, just that picture of connecting to someone else. So
that's a very strong moment.
Mm-hmm. So with that, I asked Gene one last question. Who's your friend that loves to play?
Oh gosh, you're gonna make me finish this song.
No. I really appreciate you guys being here. I love that we got to talk about this movie. I'm hoping that somehow this conversation will convince Gene to upgrade it from like a 3.5 stars to like a 4 stars.
Yeah,
out of 5.
Yeah,
but
man, the more I talk about this and think about it, I was probably too harsh on that, on a 3.5 out of 5.
It killed me. One of the reviews I saw was 4.5 out of 5 stars, and the entire piece was like 800 words, and they didn't say anything that they disliked about the movie. I was like, you can't do that. If you didn't give it that half a star, it has to stand for something. You have to point that out. So,
well, with that, I want to give both you guys a chance to let people who have enjoyed this conversation continue it with you or me or you. So you never know who I was ewing first. So, since you're the new guy, Gene, you get to let people know how they can follow your work or get in contact with you. So how can they do that?
Well, you can find me primarily at letterebemovies.com. That's the blog that I run. I write on there with, 5 other people. We don't just do movie reviews. We do, we've got coming up real soon, a moral dilemma dialogue. We do things like analyze the moral dilemma in a film, and 2 of our writers take 2 opposing viewpoints and argue that viewpoint. And it's sort of like a debate, but it's not they don't play back and forth. They just argue that point. But we do all kinds of stuff like that. We do a couple television show reviews as well. So that's letterebemovies.com. We're on Facebook as well. And on Twitter, Let There Be Movies. I also participate in a podcast called A Clear Lens. It's a Christian apologetics and worldview podcast. It's also a blog, clearlens.org, I think. And I do some writing on there as well. So find me there.
Awesome. Joe, how can people follow what you do?
Yeah, I am on Twitter. I'm underscore Joe Darnell, and I talk there socially with most anyone and everyone in the world. So I don't waste time on Facebook. I actually, you want to know something, guys? I still have my Facebook account, but I deleted the apps off of my phone. So the only way to get me on Facebook is if I'm sitting at my desk in front of my Mac. I'm sick and tired of Facebook itself. But if you want to catch me, you can catch me by Twitter. Give me a shout out there, underscore Joe Darnell. And I have some other podcasts. I'm going to be soon rebooting my movie podcast with a few other awesome podcasters. So no reason to really mention it right now. But if you're interested, it's called Movie Bite. We have many other episodes in the can. Then there's two other shows. I have a coffee and hot drinks home brewing show called Top Brew. So find my coffee show. It's called Top Brew. Yes, totally. Wow. Me, I know. Kill me. sue me. Whatever. And then my other show is called tectonic.fm. Well, at least that's where it's at. The website is tectonic.fm, and we talk about technology and culture. So that's tectonic.fm, and you'll find us. And yeah, so those are my other regular shows.
Awesome. And I'll make sure all this stuff is in the show notes. So any of you who didn't get some of that, or maybe we weren't sure what some of those addresses were, we will definitely have them right in the show notes. You can follow me, Fizz, at Fizzification on Twitter, or you can follow the show at Real World Theo. If you'd like to know more about Real World Theology, if you haven't already, then visit our website, realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter, and look for new episodes the 1st, 10th, and 20th of every month, and you can find them on iTunes or Stitcher. So you can even subscribe and make it even easier. If you enjoy it, please, please, please review the show. We really appreciate your feedback. We really appreciate all of your 5-star reviews. like I said, we want to get up there so we can get more people involved in the conversations, because there's a lot of great people with a lot of great opinions. We're trying to attract like non-YouTube commenters. That kind of, you know, conversation, but
you mean real people,
anyway,
with, you know, names and not avatars.
But we are so grateful for our excellent guests. So please follow them on social media, follow them around the web. Meanwhile, we're very, very thankful for you, the listeners, who are taking time to make us part of your weeks. And with that said, until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Ta-ta.
Later.
My unsaid goal that I'm now saying out loud of doing this podcast, some people are like, oh, you're trying to engage culture, you're trying to, educate or start conversations or really dig into this thing, explore theme.
Why would you want to do that, Fizz?
All those things that maybe I've convinced people of. It's really about making or networking connections in all 50 states and hopefully almost every country eventually. That way I've always got somewhere to stay whenever I go on vacation. that's the real goal. Know someone from everywhere.
Well, that is a long-term goal, my man.
I'm doing pretty well, I think. I guess Texas being its own country, I could stay anywhere in the country of Texas right now. I feel like I've got people in western, eastern, southern Texas. It's great.